Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is the New Books in Science, Technology, and Society podcast. Welcome to the podcast, and thanks very, very much for being with me today. I just finished talking with Phaedra Daifa about her new book, Masters of Uncertainty, Weather Forecasters and the Quest for Ground Truth. This came out in the year 2015 with the University of Chicago Press. Now, this is a book that works really interestingly on two different levels, and those levels also mutually inform and co-create each other. On one level, what Phaedra does is take us into a really intricately woven account of the practices and conditions of work and of practice and of knowledge making that are undertaken by a community of practitioners who collectively produce an object that many of us consume daily without really necessarily thinking about the contexts and the significance of the context of production of that object. And that is the weather forecast. One of the things that you'll hear us talking about in the next hour is, for me, the way that really thinking and paying attention really carefully to the practices of these weather forecasters, for me, changes what I'm doing when I look at this object every morning. And so it's a really, really cool and I think very interesting and very relevant and very fascinating case study. Whether you are someone who thinks about and experiences the weather, right, and who among us is not a person like that, or whether you are a scholar of or someone who's interested in STS, the study is very, very carefully embedded in a context of the historiography and social study of science that's very, very interesting in terms of kind of enriching how we think about and think with those fields. On another level, what the study does is it uses this case in order to develop a theory of decision-making, right? So this is a sociological study that uses weather forecasting to come up with a model and a conceptual way of thinking about what decision-making is, how it works, what it does. And so what you'll hear by the end of the interview is the way that the book uses most of its chapters to work out this really interesting, careful theory of decision-making as a social practice, as something that's habitual and practical. And then toward the end of the book, kind of tries out this theory in other fields that are quite different from weather forecasting, but that are also based on decision-making. And those are finance and medicine. So you'll hear quite a bit about medicine toward the end of the hour. So I will leave you to it. I think it's a super fascinating book. It's really, really interesting, again, on both of these levels. And I hope you have a chance to get your hands on a copy, to explore it yourself, pay special attention to the commercial fisherman. You'll hear about that in a bit. It's a super fascinating chapter. And there's, including the interviews with the fishermen, there's lots of really interesting interview material in the book to explore and work your way through. So thanks as ever for listening. Thanks for the support of the channel that represents. And I hope you enjoy. Have fun. I'm here today to talk with Phaedra Daifa about her new book, Masters of Uncertainty, Weather Forecasters and the Quest for Ground Truth. Welcome to the podcast, Phaedra. Welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. And thanks very much for making time to talk with me about what I thought was a really fascinating book. So welcome, and thanks for making the time.
Thank you, Carl. Excited to be here.
So let's start, as is traditional for the channel, by talking about the big, broad question. How did you come to work on the sociology of science as your academic field?
You know, the long or the short answer.
Any answer you want to share.
So I became a sociologist of science, I guess, because I wouldn't become a philosopher. So I majored both in sociology and philosophy. I fell in love with philosophy, I should say, before I fell in love with sociology. But I came out of philosophy realizing that the pursuit of universal truths, truths with capital T, is a misguided endeavor. So therefore, if I couldn't become a philosopher, I wouldn't become a philosopher, I would have to become a sociologist. And that's my undergraduate studies. So cut to I'm arriving in the U.S., intent on pursuing exploring the foundations of knowledge, but not having a clear sense of much else. I'm at the University of Chicago at this point, trying to figure out, you know, how to do that, taking courses on the professions, And then I stumbled into anthropology of knowledge and science course. Up to this point, I knew of Kuhn, I knew of Mannheim, but not much else. And now I'm exposed to Latour, North Cetina, you know. And I realized, you know, knowledge, but right now in the knowledge society, in the knowledge economy, it is science and technology. So I already knew I wanted to discuss the socially embedded truth and how it is produced. But now I'm beginning to understand that truth and knowledge is socio-technically embedded. So that is how I'm starting. I became a sociologist of science to begin with. And that is how, you know, it what brought me into my all my projects since then, I should say. So that.
That's amazing.
Exploration.
And you are so articulate that I think if anyone ever asks me a question about anything about myself, I'm just going to direct them to you and have you answer it because it's so
Well, don't
clear.
Do it as I did.
It's
it was
so
just
clear. No, I love it. Okay, so
fumbling in the dark.
No. So that's great. So let's come to the book that we're talking about today. So the book Masters of Uncertainty treats weather forecasting as what it calls arguably the most iconic example of a decision-making task riddled with deep uncertainty. It understands weather forecasters as masters of uncertainty, as the title would indicate, or at least as masters at mastering uncertainty, which is, I think, a really interesting twist that happens in the beginning of the book. The book uses a very, very careful local sociological study of a particular community of weather forecasters to develop a much more broadly applicable sociology of decision-making. So, Phaedra, how did you come to this particular project? And by this particular project, I mean both a focus on a sociology of decision-making, but also on sort of looking at weather forecasters as a way to get at that larger conceptual problem.
It's a good question. So, initially, well before I decided this will ultimately, and that happened at the book stage, this became a book about a sociology of decision making. I was drawn to meteorology for very clear STS, sociology, science and technology studies kind of reasons. And at that point, more clearly, and now this is becoming less the case, thankfully, what we knew of science in the production of knowledge and information was through laboratory studies, experimental science. And there, you know, we had a very good sense of the tinkering and the messiness, you know, opening up the black box, blah, 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 you know, things that we, as STS, and I'm saying blah, 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 it's very important, but as STS people, this is the Bible, right? And that's the first contribution that one thinks about of what STS brought into the field of social science. But, you know, especially as I was reading, Pickering, The Mangle of Practice, you know, I was saying, how about nature? You know, how about the messiness when you cannot capture nature? How about, you know, scientists who cannot act in a distance like Latour tells us? How about, you know, when you cannot have a laboratory to raise a world? How about those kind of scientists? And it started to become more clear to me that most expertise now and expert communities kind of live in this hybrid space, not entirely in the field, but not entirely in the lab. And I was thinking of different case studies. You know, this is the case when I'm, you know, trying to come up with a dissertation project, right? And I had several false starts. At some point, I was thinking of new science. And at some point, just, you know, meteorology, right? Weather forecast. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to know when these guys have it wrong, right? You just look outside, right? And that's what originally brought me to meteorology, because this is a place where you can see science, but also how nature meshes up with the instruments and the people. You know, you have a much more messier way of imposing structure out of the noise. And that's what brought me into the, you know, these negotiations in order to create some sense of what is happening and the way that you do not see it in the lab, exactly because the lab is, you know, is created there to create this aseptic environment, right? But some fields, no, you cannot do that. You cannot bring the weather into the lab, not in the way you can bring rats into the lab, not in the way you can bring bacteria into the lab, right? And that is what brought me into weather forecasting to begin with.
Excellent. Yeah, so we'll talk about the nature of your fieldwork in a little bit. But first, this is a project that started as a graduate dissertation, right, as a PhD dissertation,
yeah.
And it morphed into a book. So can you tell us a little bit about that metamorphosis? Mm-hmm. Were there any things that sort of changed significantly in the transformation from one stage to the other?
So I would say, you know, in several ways they did. First of all, because unbeknownst to me, and that was a lucky coincidence, when I entered the field, when I went to the National Weather Service, and I did not know that, you know, I wish I could say I did, but I did not. When I, you know, hit the ground in 2003, the National Weather Service was undergoing a major technological transformation. We can talk about this, you know, later. But that was also a moment of great crisis and controversy, which enabled me to see, you know, the weather forecasting in motion and to see things that would be invisible because, you know, they normalized otherwise. But that also meant that once I finished the, you know, the first book, which was a dissertation book, you know, got a job, or, you know, then I wanted to think more about this, and I thought more about this. So things were already marinating in my head and maturing already, so I was already thinking more bigger as it is. But I also felt, because I had the luxury of going back, what happens now, 5 years later? And I've kept in touch with the guys. What happens now? Now where the, you know, crisis has kind of settled down, you know, what does the field look like? So I collected more data. I started reading more broadly, you know, brought in more other conversations. And I saw that the book, you know, could make a bigger argument, or could weigh in on a bigger range of conversation rather than just conversation about STS. And that is why, you know, ultimately the book then becomes a book about the sociology of decision making more broadly, with STS now and science technology studies and the literature there weaving in together and becoming the translator, if you want, of all, you know, of theories from cognitive science, from organizational studies, from phenomenology, from pragmatist theory, that come together to weigh in, to figure out exactly how are these guys, you know, how, you know, are able to master uncertainty, with weather forecasting now becoming really important, not just because they deal with the weather and nature, but really because, you know, this is a field that, you know, where uncertainty is iconic. I mean, this is the butterfly effect. If you're thinking about, you know, it's the iconic status of weather forecasting and how they have to deal with uncertainty is, you know, it's hard to overlook. And at the same time, as one reads further into the decision-making literature, weather forecasters, perhaps surprisingly to some, you know, certainly to me when I first had to think about it, you know, are in fact, much of all the decision-making experts, in quotation marks, are the ones that are best calibrated. They have a better sense, that is, of when they are right or they're about, you know, when they can be confident about the decisions and not, right? So they have in this enviable position to have a better sense of how they're doing, not only because they have great models, you know, and we will talk about their models, but also because they are able to get real-time feedback on their decisions. So this, you know, so then starting the decision-making at the field of weather forecasting becomes a good case study for understanding decision-making more broadly. And that is then becomes the premise and the aim of the book.
Fantastic. So let's get right into it. And thank you so much again for articulating that so clearly. So the nature of your fieldwork, you've just talked a little bit about it. You were at a particular office that's generalized and I think pseudonymized, right, as the NEBRO office of the National Weather Service. And this was over 5 years between 2003 and 2008, as you indicate early in the book. And the nature of that fieldwork that you describe here included kind of being there as a participant observer for cycles of weather reporting. It involved interviews, and as we'll talk about toward the end, I think, of our conversation, it also involved interviewing not just weather forecasters, but commercial fishermen, right, and people that were consumers of these forecasts as well as the producers. So it's really, really interesting, and we'll talk about elements of that over the course of the conversation. But you just mentioned something that I'd like to kind of open out into and ask you about right in this early stage, and that's the importance of pragmatist theory. Now, early on in the book, and I'm just going to very briefly lay this out for listeners to provide a little bit of conceptual groundwork, and then I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit about pragmatism, okay? So you mentioned early on in the introduction that there are core assumptions that guide the study, and there are four of them, and I'm just going to read these out, and then we'll kind of dive in. The first one, decision-making takes place within a more or less institutionalized field of action. that over time affords its members a certain stock of knowledge. Okay, so they had this institutionalization aspect. Two, this stock of knowledge consists of cognitive heuristics and decision-making techniques that help initially frame and specify the empirical context of action. Four, and then we'll come back to three. It's within the evolving micro-context of action and the human and non-human others populating it that decision-making takes form first and foremost. And then we'll circle back to three. Decision-making action may not be rational, but rarely is it routinized or unreflective. Instead, it's habitual and eminently practical. Okay, so that word practical, right, and the importance of habit, this is something that comes up over and over again in the study. And you've just, as I mentioned, invoked the importance of pragmatist theory in kind of providing a foundation for what's happening here. So can you maybe start us off as we dig in by talking a little bit about the importance of pragmatism and American pragmatist theory specifically as a conceptual touchstone for what you were doing here?
Sure. I'm especially influenced by John Dewey, you know, who talks about deliberation and by this he means judgment and decision making as a fundamentally practical activity. He says all deliberation is a search for a way to act. Right? That is why we think. There's no other reason for us to deliberate other than the fact that we are confronted with a troubling instance, and we have to find a way around it, right? She says the beginning of, you know, deliberation is a troubled activity, and its conclusion is a course of action which straightens it out. So decision-making happens in a particular context, and by that I mean it is there because it needs to solve a particular task. It's very practical, it's very situated, and that is why, you know, even though it becomes equipped and it becomes streamlined through particular, you know, institutional support, right? How it will actually play out cannot predict it by knowing that organizational context and that empiric, you know, that institutional environment, but it plays out based on the particular ad hoc environment. Practical action, right? Mm-hmm. So basically, my unit of analysis then is not individual. Right? As usual, the psychology of decision making, right? Psychology would tell us, you know, or the unit of analysis is not the organization or the group, as organizational theories and occasionally other sociologists would say, but the unit of analysis is the task at hand, the specific task at hand, the particular problem, the decision making, whether it be forecasting, whatever kind of problem solving activity, is enlisted to resolve. And that is what pragmatism is all about, right? It's pragmatic. It is, you have to be practical. Mm-hmm. And you're going to enlist all sorts of resources at hand to figure it out. Mm-hmm. What is interesting here, and you know, you can stop me whenever you know you want here,
No,
it's kind of weighs in and kind tries to expand on or when, you know, in discussion of practice theory, like from Bourdieu to, you know, today's theories of practice, you know, because ultimately practice theory ends up equating practice with routines, with rote action, you know, non-thinking, unreflexive action. And by linking decision making, which is fundamentally the word, it's agentic, right? You make decisions, right? You are in the present. With practice, decision making practice, this kind of oxymoron, right? It kind of tries to refresh our notion of decision making and to talk about habit and habitual action, not as routine, not as routinization, but habit is something that the pragmatists call something that are tools that habits are not put into us. We are the ones who decide and equip ourselves with habits, right? So what pragmatism does and what my theory of decision making is trying to do by moving beyond the individual and organization to look at decision making at the unit, at the task at hand, is to reinstate decision makers as the makers of decisions, right? Mm-hmm. As something that is crafty that is locally rational, that cannot be routinized, cannot afford to be routinized. Mm-hmm. And that is where pragmatism comes in very handy, along with STS and all these other theorists.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And I think this is hopefully already making clear to listeners that even though this is a book about this very specific context, and we're going to get right to that in a moment, it's doing conceptual work that's much more broadly relevant, well beyond the context of weather forecasting, as fascinating as that context might be, right? And I think already that's becoming clear in your evocation of the importance of pragmatism and decision-making. But let's get to that context. So the first chapter introduces the forecasting operations of the broader organization that the local office, right, that you were doing mm-hmm. field work in is part of, and this is the National Weather Service, which was established in 1870. It situates the National Weather Service within a larger field of weather forecasting, and this introduces something that seems like it was a really signal moment in your field work, and something that's already come up very briefly, and this is this controversy or this crisis surrounding a transition to a digital graphical forecast. You talk here about the introduction in the early 2000s of something called the Interactive Forecast Preparation System, which created a kind of paradigm shift, in the words of some of your actors, right, in which they were expected to come up with graphical grid formulations of their predictions. Now, briefly, can you introduce for us what you think is important for us to understand about this controversy and this crisis to kind of set the stage for where we're going to go for the rest mm-hmm. of the book?
So the reason why I put this chapter there, and arguably it's a dense chapter, I tell some people to skip this chapter, go into the more juicy action chapters.
I think it's juicy. Oh, this is juicy.
I know, but for some people who are not so much organization-minded, it's a dense chapter. And some of my reviewers were saying maybe you want to put it later. But the reason why I put it there is exactly because I introduce institutional environment there to actually show, how, the task at hand, even though it is the first and foremost driver of decision-making, action is really supported and depends in a fundamental way on the institution in which it is embedded. And we see this because what happens, we see a fundamental crisis, not just the institutional level, but the fundamental level of what is a good forecast? Who am I? Am I a good forecaster? To whom am I forecasting this thing for? Not because there is a controversy in the dramatic sense of, oh my God, they bombed the forecast and 10 people died somewhere, which happens, right? But just because of this, of a very otherwise mundane thing of a change in tools, right? Institutional, means of supporting the task. And this is what happens is until this moment, at the National Weather Service, weather forecasters used the models, and obviously they were very much still dependent, already dependent on their screens and their computers. They were studying models and guidance on their screens. But after they were done, figuring out what was going on and what the forecast was going to be, and they were doing that in their head, supposedly, right? Then they would turn to a text screen and they would just type out a forecast, a very, clear, very dry 5, 6, 10 sentences forecasts, for the next few hours to 7 days. And the forecast National Weather Service is a 7-day forecast. We can talk about this later if you'd like. With introduction of the IFPS, or more broadly the NDFT, the National Digital Forecast Database, the digitization of the forecast. Now, what becomes digitalized is not the evaluation of model and observational guidance, which already was digitalized. What now becomes digitized is the production itself of the forecast. Now, forecasters are not just writing a text, but they just now actually are painting the forecast on their screens. And how they do that? They start by uploading their preferred model. It's already a solution of a forecast solution by one of the computer forecast models, right, or a combination of that onto their screens, and then they tweak it. They have multiple tools, software tools with which they can tweak that model to better fit into their vision of what the forecast is going to be. So now it all is digital. And then you have other tools like a text generator that takes that forecast that is digital and graphical, and then transforms it into a variety of outputs, including the legacy text, right? And but that, so that sounds okay, fine. You know, still you have a text focus. What's the big deal? But it was a very big deal, as it turns out, you know, because multiple things happened. First of all, these guys were saying, who wants this? Who wants to look at pictures, pretty pictures? Who cares about pictures? People want a text. Now they were not writing a text. In the text, you can hedge what you're saying better. There are less lines in the text. The resolution of the graphical forecast is now 2.5 by 2.5 square kilometer. That is a very fine resolution, out to 7 days, sometimes hourly. A forecast of 2.5. That is a lot of confidence in your forecast to put out there, where before you were just writing 10 sentences. Furthermore, from office to office, and there are 122 offices, I should say, the National Weather Service. The National Weather Service, unlike many other weather services around the world, is still highly decentralized. And that's a good thing, but that's a different conversation. And that's a very big debate now, but we might not get to it. But the point with this is, and before the forecast became graphical and digitized, you could pass the boundaries of the area of forecasting responsibility of one office and enter another office. And sometimes, if you were lucky, you'd be looking at two different types of weather because the forecasts were that different. But nobody would know unless you were driving and you had the focus and you were paying close attention. You wouldn't know. But now, when everything is graphical and there's pretty pictures, you see it online on this digital database, the different colors, right, and different values are different colors, they are jarring. You know, they are there, right? So what the weather services are doing, they had to do that before they could allow this digital forecast to become operational, and they had to delay the official issuance of that forecast because of all the resistance was, now all the forecasts have to be consistent across boundaries. And of course, forecasts were saying, but my forecast is better than the other guys. Why should I give in, right? So there's all this stuff now, that is coming up, driven by a mundane change of tools, And it was really interesting to see. So the institutional environment now was shook up, and I was able to see that, understand, really get a deep inside look, without even, planning to, into the culture, like what animates forecasting, what are they there to do? And it allowed me to do that in a very exquisite way.
As we move into the book, the next chapter actually takes us into really, I think, really rich detail in terms of your exploration of one particular office in which this is happening, right? And as you're talking about it as well, I'm thinking, like, just as a footnote, someone who's listening who develops TV scripts, a local weather bureau, right, given my reading of your book, would be such a great setting for a fabulous sitcom. So someone needs to make a sitcom of this and hire you as an expert writer, and you'll make millions of dollars and then be able to retire, and it'll be amazing.
I'm not going to make millions.
You heard it here.
What did you say?
You heard it here. Okay, but let's actually get into this detail. So chapter 2 takes us into the particular environment of this Niebuhro office of the National Weather Service. This was apparently, and I won't go into too much detail here, but just to signal for listeners, this was infamous for its, in the words of the book, for its challenging work environment, right? So at the same time, you make a very compelling case that this is a particular locality that lets us understand the whole, right? This is representative in important ways. But it's interesting because the book, at least in this chapter, mentions repeatedly that this was an office that was also known for being particularly challenging as a work environment. Okay. So the chapter...
Go ahead.
No, go for it.
No, so I was, yeah, so the whole point of the chapter, and it was here, right, so the first chapter, or the previous chapter was about, the institutional environment, but now I'm getting more of this notion of environment. So now we're looking at the local environment, at the cultural level, at the meteorological level, right, and how, practice is embedded in those kind of environments. And local matters, right? Mm-hmm. It matters, to the institution. That is why it has decided to not centralize its operations, but have, divvy up the nation in 122 local localities, meteorological and geopolitical, and put people there, you know, to forecast the weather. And they do that because they recognize the microclimatic idiosyncrasies that the models cannot pick up. Even as they become more, the resolution becomes better and they become more sensitive, it's still very difficult, especially in some regime and especially under conditions that are very threatening. You know, the risk is too high to leave it to central operations, but also because they recognize that different audiences and publics have different needs. So with an interesting illustration of that is the Niborough office was, even though, you know, its area of forecasting responsibility is 30 miles, you know, it actually was servicing four different states, or you know, not all of them, but parts of two full states and a quarters of others, mm-hmm. and which also means that, for example, for a snow advisory, the criteria for one of those states, because of climatic but also of infrastructure reasons, the threshold for issuing a warning was higher than for the other states, right? Mm-hmm. So you see how the variability and locality matters. Mm-hmm. And the National Weather Service is very aware of that, even as it begrudges the fact that you have inconsistency and you have organized, you know, you have fiefdoms, blah, 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 and that's bad and we don't look good. At the same time, it cannot afford not to recognize the importance of local embeddedness.
Exactly. And you take us into how this work, right, how this local work happens on a day-to-day basis. So the chapter introduces us to the basic routines of a forecast shift at the office, from the moment that an incoming forecaster is briefed by the outgoing forecaster to the moment that she sends. And I'm using she because the chapter uses she, although most of these forecasters are men and most of them are white. So there are all kinds of interesting, like, gendered and other kinds of analyses here. But to the moment that she sends the forecast out into the world. Now, there are three main components of this forecasting task. There's data analysis, there's deliberation, and there's forecast production. And you take us into the steps and the practices of each one of these stages. But one of the things that comes up repeatedly that's, I think, particularly interesting, especially given what you've just talked about in terms of the graphic nature of forecast production, one of the things that's interesting about the data analysis description is the importance of aesthetics and visuality. So you talk about the importance, and this is going to come up again over and over again, of visual pattern recognition on the part of the forecasters. But you also describe weather forecasting as something that is predicated on aesthesis, right? A communal aesthesis, shared modes of looking, shared modes of reasoning and doing. So before we move on to kind of the further chapters of the book, can you just kind of very briefly talk about this notion of aesthesis as it shapes what you're doing here? Because it keeps coming up after this in important ways in the other chapters as well.
Right. So this notion I picked up from Aristotle, who talks about aesthesis. I talk about this here as a meteorological aesthesis. The fundamental point is of this aesthesis, which is situational awareness. So what the institution does, you know, the National Weather Service as, you know, an organization, but the whole profession in general, is given that, and he has to recognize this, given that our perception, our perspective is positional, meaning that our sense of what is going to happen is going to be biased one way or the other. And this is coming from psychology, cognitive science, you know, that we are prey, as humans, we are prey to particular biases in our decision-making. What the National Weather Service does is it makes a virtue of the fact that we are biased, right, as humans, that we are given informational and time constraints, or we are prone to pick up particular clues and make decision based on them, even though they are not full, we don't have all the information that we could have, and that's where we are biased. So what it does is it is purposefully biasing decision makers to a particular way of looking and understanding and deciphering and evaluating the weather and acting. So it inculcates them with a particular, what I call, meteorological aesthesis, a particular way of, that is epistemic, but that's very much also aesthetic of looking and evaluating the models, a very much aesthetic way of looking at it. And so, you know, they can so especially when they have no, don't have a lot of time, in situations that there's not much time to act, it's visual cues that really drive how, you know, and they don't have time to act. They actually have to pick very quickly on visual cues and push the trigger. And that is something that happens at the very visceral level. They see something and just doesn't, it looks bad. It's that. And they you know, especially in convective weather system, in summer weather, which is very fast, there's little time to act. The cues that they learn, you know, when you see this, when you see a cell, you know, look like a seahorse, push the button, like, you know, act, mm-hmm. Issue a warning. They're visual cues. So it's a very aesthetic way of inculcating, priming these guys of making decisions, of imbuing them with situational awareness. And they would do that in order to make particular, you know, organizationally approved solutions, decision-making solutions, attractive to them, again, on epistemic, but also on aesthetic and practical grounds, but also to shield them from other possibilities, right? And that is what I mean by meteorological aesthesis. And
mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that you just mentioned, I just want to briefly touch on, is really interesting and important in ways that might not be immediately obvious, or the relevance of which might not be immediately obvious to listeners. And this is your invocation of the importance of pattern recognition for convective weather and in summer forecasting. This was actually for me as a consumer of weather mm-hmm. forecasts, right? And we'll talk about that a little bit toward the end of our conversation, but I don't tend to think, or I didn't before reading this book, about the fundamentally different craft and the different kinds of practices that go into forecasting in the summer versus the winter, right? I mean, we look at the forecast, we take in the forecast is the forecast, but one of the things that happens specifically in chapter 5, so this is why I'm mentioning this for listeners, is that you talk about the importance of kind of convective weather, which is something that's characteristic of the summer, and the very different ways of looking and the different timescales and the different kinds of practices that are undertaken by weather forecasters in the summer versus the winter. So we'll get to that briefly when we talk about Chapter 5 and the temporal regimes of meteorological decision-making, but I just want to mark that as something that I think is particularly interesting here in terms of how you're helping us as consumers actually see and understand, right, the kinds of practices that are producing the objects that we're consuming. So for me, that was actually transformative in perhaps ways that are unexpected. But, yeah, so thank you. So let's actually move on, though, from here, and thank you for opening up this notion of aesthesis. So as we move from chapter 2 to 3, you look at what you call the omnivorous appetite for information on the part of the forecasters. So this is really interesting, and you introduce for us the very different kinds of information that they're taking in order to make these predictions. And those include not just data, but in different ways, in different contexts, the materiality of the weather, right? Looking out the window or going outside to feel the rain in terms of how these forecasters are managing information. So this is a really, really interesting part of the chapter. What I would like to ask you to open up a little bit is a notion that you use to make sense of these practices, and this is a notion of collage. Mm-hmm. You invoke collage as a way of making sense of the processes of what you call assembling, appropriating, superimposing, juxtaposing, and blurring information here. So can you talk for us about the importance and the nature of collage here?
So one of the main, I should say, empirical puzzle that kind of organized my research once I entered the field was the fact that here are these guys that have all this weather in front of them. And in fact, this is a very animated weather. You know, their models are looping. You know, the weather in, not in a real sense, but in a very, you know, near real sense, comes alive on their screens. And they have a lot of weather to look at. And yet, almost daily, in quite patterned ways, they still go outside to look for themselves what is, in quotation, really going on. So what is this about the ontology of the weather? Why, you know, the different ontological registers of the weather that they are enlisting to understand, to make sense, to resolve the determinacy of the atmosphere, and to come up with a forecast. becomes important, and especially the fact that they have to go outside again to deal with nature, right? How do they do that, right? The notions that we have so far from STS are not satisfactory because these are not kind of these are not types of data that are easily assembled together. They're not seamlessly assembled. You know, Latour, you know, uses notions of multiple cars. Like you taxonomize them, right? That's, I'm making up a verb, but you know, but these are unequal pieces. They're empty pieces. How do they create order out of this? And that is what I was reaching for a heuristic to understand how, you know, out of this tinkering. And they, as you were saying, they have developed this as, you know, they have developed this omnivorous taste for information to overcome the you know, the limited amount of data. Even though it's a lot of data, it's still limited data to resolve the uncertainty of weather forecasting. You know, so they have collected all this smorgasbord of data. How do they reconcile it into something that they can distill then and produce a seamless forecast? And that is why the collage made a lot of sense here. And the collage exactly it provides this notion of craftiness, of art, but also science. Mm-hmm. It alludes to the sense of you know, of complex information, where, you know, it's above and beyond its individual parts, and it's not just a heuristic. This is actually now what they're doing, mm-hmm. By graphically producing the forecast. So it can be a powerful heuristic to understand decision making, especially in a culture of visualization technologies, of how decision making happens now in a lot of expert communities, of how, you know, at a cognitive level. But also, at least in the case of weather forecasting, it is actually a practical activity, mm-hmm. because they cut and paste information and they put it on their screen, which looks like a collage, until they use other powerful algorithms and software that it looks seamless, mm-hmm. at the end. But the activity is a collage.
And you talk about this also in terms of what you characterize as a form of disciplined improvisation. Mm-hmm. Did you want to speak to that a little bit?
Sure. So what is interesting about this organization, and I would argue increasingly about many expert organizations that have to deal with this kind of uncertainty that cannot be reduced to risk, right? That cannot reduce uncertainty into calculable risk, is they have to actually celebrate uncertainty. They have to celebrate tinkering and improvisation. So that, which means then that that actually forecasters, and you know, in the National Weather Service directives to its forecast, they have their protocols of how to produce forecasts. Forecasts are encouraged to look beyond the information that comes to the screen for other types of data, to reach for what is called, that's an actual term, that's an institutional term, a total observation, mm-hmm. to use other and different kinds of data, right? So here we see improvisation and tinkering as institutionalized action, the kind of action that they become socialized into doing, an action that is improvisational and yet disciplined, because they are primed through meteorological aesthesis to favor and privilege particular data and particular combinations of data as the right, correct, and aesthetically appropriate also solutions to the weather problem of the day.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you so much, Phaedra. Now, as we move forward, you take us into a couple of chapters that we're not going to have time to really talk about in any real detail, purely because of the time that we have left. But I want to just mention and mark for listeners. So chapter 4 takes readers into the particularities of hazardous weather forecasting. Now, this is really important, in part because the primary directive of the National Weather Service, as you remind us here, is to protect life and property. So because of this, hazardous weather forecasting entails particular kinds of pressures relative to regular weather forecasting and particular ways of working out risk. And you take us here into a kind of thick description of two weather events that represent two particular kinds of errors, right? There's a case of over forecasting of snow, which is what you call a type one error, a false positive. And then there's a case of under forecasting. And this is a forecast that missed the first snow squalls of the season and resulted, and this isn't just like a, you know, a oops conceptual thing. It actually resulted in accidents, right? And traffic standstills. And so the material consequences of these decision-making practices really come out very, very strongly here in this chapter. And this is a type two error or false negative. So I won't ask you to talk about this in detail, but this is not because it's not an interesting and important chapter, which then leads us into another interesting and important chapter, which we've already talked a little bit about, so we won't spend too much time. But this is the chapter, chapter five, that looks very carefully at the temporal dimensions of meteorological decision making. This chapter identifies two principles that underline the logic of forecasting, the principle of risk and of spatial scale. And it takes these principles together as a way of yielding what you give us as four temporal regimes and thus four distinct styles of decision making: emergency, extended alert, near term, and longer term. And this is the chapter that talks in detail about the differences. And I think, as I've said, very fascinating. And I'm not being hyperbolic here. I really think this is fascinating, distinctions between summer and winter forecasting. And so I particularly recommend this chapter to listeners, although I recommend all of them. Okay. But we need to, the reason I'm kind of quickly going through that is that I want to talk about the fishermen here. And the next chapter lets us do this. So let's get to the fishermen by talking about consumption. Chapter 6 looks at the relationships between the National Weather Service and its public by focusing on the consumption of weather forecasting. Okay, so let's start relatively big and then focus in. For you, what are some of the most important and interesting ways that the service conceptualizes and also engages its public? When you think about the relationship between the National Weather Service and the way it's relating to its public, what for you are the most interesting aspects of that relationship?
So this is a very, very, very hot topic. I mean, a debate. Right now, and it has been, but it's definitely, you know, it's the an existential fundamental issue and debate in the National Weather Service, and it's again very hot. I visited the National Weather Service very recently, because the Weather Service in the U.S. is 100% tax funded. It is our Weather Service, in opposition or in distinction to weather services in the UK or in Canada, other places where they've transitioned into self-finance regime, which means the whole point of the Weather Service and why, you know, it can lay claim to taxpayers' funds is because it services and it provides decision-making supports to us. As they say, it protects life and property. Problem is, the United States is a big, pretty big country with a lot of people with very, very different needs. So how can you cater to this very different contrasting and conflicting needs of all these people, even after you divide your operations in 122 locales? Mm-hmm. So how do you do that? How can you, you know, produce a product that can be consumed, right, in a way that it will justify your status as a science in the public domain? On the other side, and I'm giving you a lot of information, is the fact that this professional field is highly, there's a lot of competition now because the weather is the reason why everybody turns into the news. The weather pays. So right now, not right now, for the longest time, the private sector and the media have been vying for the position of the Weather Service. The private sector, especially, and again recently, has been arguing that it should not just be the Weather Service that is issuing warnings, but the private sector can do it just as well now. So there is no reason why the Weather Service should do that. The Weather Service should just be there to provide the data, and the data, you know, which it does already. And in fact, the data, one argument goes, should not be free, because the Weather Service should not encroach on what can be done by the private sector. So the Weather Service is highly pressed to justify its position and to rethink what it can provide as a consumable, what are its products. So it keeps rethinking and refiguring who are its customers or its clients or its audiences. And when I was right now, the discussion is very different again. I'm not going to even go into that. That's another chapter, another paper I'm writing. Mm-hmm. But at that point, because of the fact that there are too many audiences, what the National Weather Service has tried to do, and it cannot be avoided, is create this what I've called imaginary audiences, imaginary publics. It creates functional constructs of what the needs of its various publics are and comes up with a forecast that meets their needs. And there are three, broadly speaking, categories of that. It is what they used to be called then the partners, which is other government agency, emergency managers, and the other weather services, private and media, as I said. And then there are the stakeholders, which could include also other government agencies, but also big companies like electricity, et cetera, will also have a seat at the table. They actually come and talk with the Weather Service, and they have a voice, which becomes very important for shaping the forecast as it comes out and make their needs very clear. And then in a big blob, everybody else is general public. Right? And what I'm showing when I went to the Fishers, and the reason why I went to the Fishers, if I can say that, I don't know if I'm anticipating in question.
Oh, yeah. I totally
the reason why I went to the Fishers, and it also was one of the reasons why I chose the Niebuhr office out of other offices, was because arguably the fishing community is arguably the last forecast user community to directly rely on the National Weather Service forecast for its meteorological information, first and foremost, because most other publics have the luxury to, and mostly, in fact, now get their weather information through the media and or the private sector. But it is only the Weather Service that issues a marine forecast. And that is why I talked with these guys to figure out, A, in what sense the imaginary, the functional construct of who what the fishers want at the National Weather Service inside the National Weather Service office, the Niebuhr side, maps onto what fishers tell me actually that they want and need and how happy they are. That's why I talk to them, right? And as it turns out, the one-size-fits-all measure of the Weather Service barely hits the surface of what they want. But the point is, this guy is exactly because they're such a sophisticated audience, they're fine with that, which is also very interesting. The fundamental thing to understand, though, is because I also did not just talk up with fishers at the commercial fishers, and they have a very sophisticated understanding of weather information because they are so dependent on it and they're so educated, they have to educate themselves to use it. But also even fair weather boaters that I had an opportunity to survey equally demand a sophisticated forecast, a forecast that doesn't just give them a yes or no answer. It's not a deterministic of a forecast as is the current marine weather forecast, but they actually want a probabilistic forecast, which is a big issue, a point of contention now with the Weather Service. How much, what kind of uncertainty do we want? Can we afford to communicate to the public, right? And the usual mantra, the old mantra, that animated the profession was that people cannot afford to. They don't know how to use, or they don't even want to want uncertainty. They want to know if it's going to rain or not. They don't want probability, whether it's marine weather or land weather. My research and the research of a growing number of studies show that, in fact, the public wants to and, in fact, needs to be empowered with this information. And that, is in fact, is not going to diminish the credibility of this expert decision makers, but enhance our understanding of what they're doing and help us better protect our life and property. Off my soapbox now.
No, that's great.
No, it's very interesting though, because these conversations are continuing. Yeah, it's very interesting.
And I wish we actually had another hour just to talk about this chapter, because these conversations with the commercial fishermen in again the sort of pseudonymized towns of Cod Town and Whale Town.
Yeah, it's very thinly pseudonymized.
It's like really, they're really really interesting, and it also brings up this larger point that the extent to which the forecast that's produced by the National Weather Service is considered good, right, or is valued by its users, is not necessarily have a whole lot to do with accuracy. And so you talk here also about kind of ways of valuing the weather forecast in terms of quantity of information versus accuracy. And so there's a lot of really interesting nuance that comes out of this chapter as well. And in addition to just some fascinating interviews that I would love to ask you more about, but we don't have a lot of time. But as we're coming to now the conclusion of our conversation, if you can believe that, I do want to spend just a little bit of time before we wrap up talking about the final chapter, because this is a really important chapter. So this final chapter, chapter 7, acts in lieu of a conclusion to articulate the main components of the analysis that's been worked out in the preceding chapters. And it then tests out that model, this decision-making model, in two decision-making fields, the field of finance and the field of medicine. So here, the chapter restates the main thesis of the book. And I think it's worth doing that very briefly right here. I'm reading directly from pages 197 to 198 here. Here's the thesis that it restates. Decision making is fundamentally a practical activity that relies on available heuristics, techniques, and resources, as determined by both the objective at hand and the material and symbolic context of action, to fashion a provisionally coherent solution to routine and non-routine challenges. Okay, so that's the main thesis of the book. And then what this chapter does is it kind of tests out this idea, this conceptual contribution in these two fields that I mentioned. So the first field is finance. Here, one of the things that's interesting and that happens is that the focus shifts, as you show us, from as we move from weather forecasting to finance, from natural to social phenomena, and importantly, the importance of performativity of judgment and decision making comes in. But what I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about is not finance, but medicine. And the reason I'm asking you this is that I peeked at your website and noticed that maybe what you're working on now might be related to medicine.
Yes.
So it feels like this is also a good opportunity to maybe talk about that. Okay, so here you also talk about the shift from weather forecasting to medicine, entailing other kinds of shifts from prognosis to diagnosis and from prevention to intervention. So, Phaedra, can you tell us about this case of medicine? For you, what is most interesting, what comes out most interestingly for you about this case study when we shift from weather forecasting to test this hypothesis in the field of medicine?
Sure. And as you mentioned, this is, my current book-length project that I'm pursuing, and I'm pursuing this in the case of cardiology practice, and more specifically. And what is interesting here, it's in multiple ways. While I was in the field, I kept coming back to physicians in the way weather forecasters see what they're doing as a calling, which the only other profession that readily comes to mind is doctors. Doctors always knew they want to be doctors from the time they were sick, the same way with weather forecasters. But also, there are very interesting differences here, which, beg the question, to what extent what I'm proposing here as a conceptual framework of decision-making action actually holds in supposedly very distinct fields in cases where it's not prognosis or prospective action, more generally, that is foregrounded and privileged, but it is diagnostic action. And there's a literature about medicine that actually laments what is called the ellipsis or the de-emphasis of prognosis. And in fact, now that I'm in the field, it's really stark. You know, doctors are fixated on diagnosis and treatment. Prognosis, which is kind of in my, you know, being Greek, right? For, you know, diagnosis and prognosis are the two bookends. They go together like a horse and carriage, right? No, it is a diagnosis and treatment. A prognosis is there, but it is assumed to be there. So they are not, so in medicine, they are not directly trained. So what does this mean? Is prospective action and the model I'm providing there to discuss how decision making happens by, you know, that foresight drives action, not valid. And what I'm finding is that what we know in the puzzle, you know, is that in fact prognostications, even though physicians are not trained in prognostications and prognosis, prognostications are in fact everywhere in medical practice. It drives decision making because depending on where you think this patient is going and the outcomes you're anticipating, it actually determines your diagnosis, your classification of the patient. And cardiology is a very good example, and the reason why I choose it is because it provides me and us with different temporal opportunities for action. You have chronic patients, bigger futures, and then bigger room to prognosticate. But you have also you have critical care, and you have emergency care in cardiology. So I'm able to understand, you know, the temporality that I'm exploring in the case of weather forecasting, comparing short-term, long-term, emergency with extended alerts. I'm doing this in cardiology, but also the arc of the future is much, much longer. We're talking about not 7 days as in meteorology, but we're talking about a life. So how does this play out? How, you know, so am I able to expand my model there? And the other thing about cardiology, just to be very quick, is you have a case that you do actually now have trials and evidence-based medicine. And how does it play out? How does this institutional information support play out in practice, in action? How do these guys then make practical knowledge and make practical individual judgment based on those information? How does evidence and experience collide in action in the medical field when you actually have humans, you know, just are there to consult like weather forecasters are, but actually to intervene, to heal, right? So things have become more complicated, interesting, and bloody. Forgive my pun.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Phaedra. Now, there's a whole lot more, obviously, that we could talk about. The book is very rich, but we are at the end of our conversation. Now, given that, is there anything in particular that didn't come up but that you'd like to mention for listeners, and perhaps especially for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to become readers?
I don't want to backtrack, but, you know... You know what? No, I'm going to put a full stop here, you know, and especially since we're talking about my new project, I think that I can put on a full stop and invite people to jump into the book and pick and choose.
Excellent. And you've already very generously given us a very brief introduction to the new project, but is there anything else that you'd like to mention or that's currently inspiring you that you're currently working on now that the book is out?
Since we're on medicine, one more thing, and I was already talking about these different temporalities, more temporal regimes. What is also fascinating, which I did not, given, you know, the operations of the weather service or the nature of the beast there, I did not have an opportunity to observe, but it's very important in decision-making, other decision-making fields, and I have an opportunity to see in medicine, is the fact that you have an interaction between different regimes. So you have short-term results and long-term results vying for attention. Which one, you know, do you privilege as you make your decision? Of course, it happens everywhere. You have to, you know, decide which one to privilege and pay attention first. But what is interesting with medicine, and it becomes more rich in medicine, is the fact that you have to contemporaneously, at the same time, look at both, because the point is not just deal with them, but actually heal. And how that interaction, this balancing, plays out. You know, I've identified patterns of how this happens in particular contexts. So I'm having a lot of fun doing that and really expanding on my previous temporalization of decision-making action.
Well, thank you so much for making the time, Phaedra. It's really, really genuinely been a pleasure, and best of luck in the work that you're doing right now.
Thank you so much. It was fun.
You have been listening to the New Books in Science, Technology, and Society podcast. Thanks so much for joining me today, and I'll catch you next time.